anyone can like get on Beehive and start a newsletter, but like how many can send it 1,000 days in a row?
You have sent an issue literally every day since that first issue on June 1st, 2023.
Yep. I laid the gauntlet down and said, no, we can't skip. You know, we've committed to it. The discipline is what's important.
This is the highlight of my entire career. I don't think I can leave this. The more that I discover myself in newsletter writing, the more that I really want to stay. I can't find myself anywhere else writing something else.
What have you learned about newsletter writing specifically?
The audience is already through the door. You can be concise, you can be fun. You're not begging for attention.
People don't just read for information, they read for energy. And
you need to be good enough that people turn their attention away from these like addictive like scroll mechanisms.
What's the hardest part of that consistency? What's the thing that makes you pull out your hair most often? Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My name is Francis Zierer, and today we're speaking with Matt Village and Maria Garib, the editorial team behind Mindstream, a daily AI-focused newsletter that has been sending for over 1,000 consecutive days. About a year ago, I had Adam Biddlecombe on the podcast, who is Matt's co-founder on the business side of the newsletter. We spoke about how they had built a business strong enough to be acquired by HubSpot only 17 months after sending the first issue. Today, I'm speaking with Matt and Maria about how they built the editorial side of the house. If you like this one, you're going to like that episode. I recommend go checking it out. Enjoy. Matt, you've been writing this Mindstream since the beginning. Can I confirm that you have sent an issue literally every day since that first issue on June 1st, 2023?
Yep. Confirm.
Have you ever almost skipped a day? I'm sure like after a certain point, it was like not an option, but I'm sure maybe in the first, you know, couple months, it was like, Sunday, take this one off. I don't know.
It's funny you should say that. So like really early days. So this was maybe like 2 weeks in. So we started on the 1st of June and I was going to Glastonbury Festival. Don't know if you're aware of it, but this is like the biggest music festival in the UK. So it's like a big deal to go, but it's like a 5-day experience. So me and Adam started this thing and I was like, Adam, just FYI, I'm going to be out like 5 days almost straight away. So it gets to it and Adam's like, should we just not run it? And I'm like, no, we made the commitment. It's got to go every day. So there was a period where it would have been the end of that first month where Adam wrote the newsletter for like 3 or 4 days. And that's the only time he ever did. So those are like, you know, they should be like NFTs or something, like these weird Adam editions that like no one's ever really seen because we only had like 20 or 30 subscribers then as well. I'm pretty sure he had like a picture of his dog in one. Like it was a weird
really
time.
But the bottom of the barrel.
I laid the gauntlet down and said, look, we said it's going out every day. If we skip one this early on, then, you know, that opens the door to doing it again. So it's like, no, we can't skip. You know, we've committed to it. The discipline is what's important.
What was the best artist you saw at Glastonbury that when you skipped a few days?
I think it was Arctic Monkeys, who I'm classic. A huge fan of, and I was very close to the front, so it was well worth it. I had a brilliant time, even if the quality of the newsletter may have gone like this for a few days.
Well, it worked out in the end. I read in the 1,000th issue that y'all sent a couple weeks ago as we record.
Thank you for reading.
Of course, that the 100 issues in was a big milestone. Around September 2023, you all then had 5,000 subscribers, a little over that, and decided to actually quit your jobs and do this full time. So can you tell me a little bit about what shifted over that first summer? So, you know, you guys start doing this in May 2023. For my interview with Adam, I wrote down, he'd said, he called you up and said, come to my garden shed. We're not leaving until we have a business. So that's May 2023. You start June 1st, 2023. September 2023, you go all in. What shifted? What sort of set you up to think, oh, actually, maybe we should quit our jobs and do this? 5,000 subscribers is not nothing, but it's not a lot either still.
It's not a lot, but I think it was moving a lot faster than we envisioned. So I'd done what you could barely describe as a newsletter before because I'd run a blog and then I used to like, every time I do a new blog post, I would send it out to the newsletter. So I had like 200 subscribers on this old newsletter that was on like MailChimp, right? So this is like the early days of newsletters. And yeah, I had like 200 on that and it had been going for years. So in my mind, I was like, I think when we first started, we were modeling like maybe in 6 months to a year, we can get like 1,000. Not the most ambitious modeling. And then, yeah, like over the summer, we just kind of got a bit of snowball effect. Like we were growing a lot faster. And I think we sold our first ad, which was like critical. We were like, oh, okay, you can actually make money from this. Mm-hmm. So I think from there, we were, the main limitation at that point became time. You know, we were both working full-time jobs. You know, I only had a couple of hours in the day to actually write the newsletter. We knew that we wanted to differentiate on quality, but it's like, how can we do that if the editor has only got 2 hours a day to write it? So it might not surprise you to learn that Adam pushed first. He was like, I think we should quit now. And this was like, this was probably early September, like you said. And then I said, oh, I need a little bit longer. And then I think it was a few weeks later, I ended up handing in my notice. He'd handed in his a little bit earlier. So there was like a 2 week gap where he was full time on it. And I was just like finishing my last job. And he was like messaging me like, bro, it's moving so fast. Like I'm getting so much done. I can't wait for you to join. So I came into it like 2 weeks later and was like, boom, we just like hit the ground running. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm. So Maria, you then joined about 3 months after that, January 2024. So the newsletter is about 200 days in. How did you come to join up with Mindstream?
Well, I was a target of a tech layoff that was extremely brutal. I think around that time, we were in probably the worst hyperinflation the country has ever seen before. It was so bad, and I had no other choice but to mass apply. And I think I applied that day. The day that I applied to Mindstream, I applied I think to 80 other top staff
in one day.
And one day, I had a whole Excel sheet. You know, just I went full Virgo on it, and I was extremely happy about that. After I applied to Mindstream, I was like, I got accepted into something else, and that something else was not something I really abided by. I didn't really want to do it because it was so rigid. It came from the background that I come from, technically, well, not the background, but this job that I had before, which was insurance, because I was a content creator for an insurance company. And then I reached out to Matt after I applied because I saw on TikTok, there was this thing on TikTok that said, like, if you apply to something, you should reach out again. And I kept like bombarding at Matt into, you know, please accept me, not please accept me, but, you know, see what I wrote and like, let me know if you need me to do anything. And they binned it the first time. They binned my application the first time, which still hurts, by the way. But they reached out again and they were like, we would like to offer you, you know, this, not the job, but like, we want to kind of test out your, capabilities and stuff. And they sent me some sort of test and, everything was fine. And I sent it back and I still remember the day that I did. I think I sent it the same day. I don't know, Matt, if I sent it the same day or like the day after, but I kind of went through all of their, other editions just to make sure how they write and how they do things. And I did more than was asked. And even Matt told me, like, you did even more than you asked. They offered me the job. I started off as a part-timer. Then I went into full-time after I quit the other job. It was just, you know, the rest is history.
What I remember is, so we were hiring, but it wasn't specifically for a newsletter writer. We kind of just wanted an all-rounder because it was a small team and, you know, we were doing more and more. And then Adam said, I'll take care of the hiring. You just carry on the newsletter. So I wasn't really that involved in the process. And then one day I got a LinkedIn message from Maria and it said, hey, I applied to your job listing a couple of weeks ago. And I was like, oh, never think. And I reached out to Adam and said, oh, someone called Maria's asked, can I like look over application? And we had a load of applications. And then I found her application. And the thing about Maria's we call it a CV, what you call a resume. Maria's CV was awesome, but it was like straight out of Microsoft Word 2001. It was like black and white, like just like it looks like completely out of time. So Adam had like glanced at it and like put it aside and hadn't actually read it. So I read it and went, well, her CV is actually really good. So like, why did you not reply? And then he's like, I didn't read it. So then we interviewed, but I don't think I was even part of that interview because we didn't know you were going to be like a newsletter writer. But then I set you the newsletter task and you were very good in that. So I always say like when hiring writers, and I've done this a couple more times because we have a few freelancers as well. It's like, you know, we do an interview with them and it's like great, but I'm more interested in what you can write.
The write.
Because, you know, I'd say I'm quite an introverted person and I'm much better with like the written word. So like, I'm not as bothered how someone comes across. I just want to see what they can actually do. Maria was very good in that case.
So, okay, before we get now into how you guys work together on the editorial, can you quickly describe the Mindstream product for me? What it is today, right? You send every day. First, on a day-to-day level, are there different formats for different days, or is it roughly the same each day?
Yeah, we have. So when we started, it was the same every day. It was 7 days in a row of news, and I wrote that for like 200 days in a row, so pretty daunting. We eventually realized this generates audience fatigue. So we've kind of slowly tweaked and changed. And what we have now is it's a pretty set a routine. So Monday to Friday, we still do like news cycle stuff. So it's two news stories a day. And then the Monday through the Friday, like we have little features that rotate. And then Saturday, we have like a how-to piece of content. So it's like how to do this in ChatGPT, how to do this in Gemini. And then Sunday, we kind of have a rotating slot. So sometimes it'll be an interview. So we, you know, we're very lucky to be part of HubSpot. So sometimes we'll leverage people within HubSpot. These like AI experts working on the forefront, which is amazing. Sometimes we'll have like a creator column. So like kind of our like wider network, they'll contribute a piece. And recently we've started working more with Matt Wolf, who runs the Next Wave podcast. And he's been contributing as well. So it's kind of like an ever evolving slot, but we've settled on the weekend is very separate to the sort of weekday, which I think helps.
Mm-hmm. How do you describe the editorial voice? And I would say, specifically, you could make comparisons to, you know, there's a lot of AI newsletters, a lot of popular ones. There's Superhuman, The Rundown, AI Tool Report. All three of these have been featured in Creator Spotlight previously, though two of those were before my time. But anyways, just to say, there's at least a few very popular, quite frequent, sometimes daily AI newsletter products. How would you describe Mindstream's editorial voice, and especially in contrast to these other ones?
So you have these AI newsletters that are kind of like summaries. So it's like, here's some news. And then you have at the other end of that, you have like really deep ones. So you've got like computer scientists writing really interesting stuff, generally find them on Substack, we find. We wanted to be sort of in between those where it was fun. It was interesting. I got asked recently to describe Mindstream as a character, which was actually quite difficult, but I just pictured straight away like a man. He's looking over his friend's reading a newspaper. He's looking over, he's got a beer in his hand, and he's saying, oh, he's kind of explaining the news to him, like very, very simply, like casually. That's kind of how we've always seen it. Like we thought we could compete in terms of editorial. Like that was our USP was, it's going to be like good to read, right? Mm. So we kind of based ourselves off of like opinion pieces, which is why we have a pretty strong tone of voice. And we sign off all our articles with little quips. Whereas I think if you read some other newsletters, they're very dry. And I think if you're trying to outsource that voice as well, you know, if you've got like a bigger team, it kind of gets diluted. But because we're a very like tight knit team with a very clear ideal of how we want our voice, it kind of it comes for every day.
Yeah. Maria, when you joined, so when did you actually become full time? Do you know around what number newsletter, what date that was?
I actually don't. I feel like
I think it was about a month after you joined.
Okay. So
probably about 250.
Mm-hmm. So my question then is, when you joined, I'm curious for both of you, Maria, I'll start with you here, how you got up to speed on the editorial voice. I know I've hired somebody to work with Creator Spotlight, and that was my big worry, is like, I need to find the right person who seems like they get the sort of writing we're doing and can do this, and I'll read the writing, etc. It can be hard when it's like a one person editorial operation to bring somebody in.
Yeah.
How did you get up to speed?
Well, I was working. I'm still working in marketing when, you know, like when everything had happened. And like, I started off with marketing by mistake, by the way, because my background is actually international affairs. And I was working with journalists, you know, my whole life. And it was all politics and, you know, this and that. And sometimes whenever you feel like you're cornered in a place where you don't have any sort of information and you need to come out with something for like other newsletters, and I'm saying this from a political perspective, you need to reach out to other people and emulate their style. And that's how it started, kind of like I think I started learning from that day. Even in marketing, when I shifted into marketing, I sort of looked out for other people and what they used to do and made what they have sort of better and sort of not copy. I'm not going to say copy. Copying sounds ew, but same thing. And when I joined Mindstream, I think when both Matt and Adam sat me down, And they told me that we need to emulate some sort of style. And one of the smartest editorial decisions I think both of them came out with was that they made early on, obviously, was learning how to do it the hustle style. Mm. And, you know, it is AI is an extremely complicated topic, you know, for a lot of people. And if you present it in a way that is not so traditional and like non-traditional tech newsy sort of tone, people mentally they check out very quickly and they don't want to, they just scroll back. When it comes to the hustle, I never really heard about the hustle before. I kind of like started learning about this because these guys told me about it. We figured out like something extremely important with them is that people don't just read for information, they read for energy. And that's what the hustle has. It has so much energy. It's so witty, so smart. And I started sort of copying their style in a sense, that tone, so that we can catch more people and get more people to like AI rather than just scroll back and like not look back.
Yeah, we would study the hustle every day. We would go on a call and read it, which obviously they're a HubSpot media product. So like, can you picture the full circle moment of we went from like studying them to like working with them? It's pretty mind blowing. On the tone stuff as well, I would say like, Maria, straight off the bat, was pretty good at emulating it. And then obviously, like, I'm there editing it, so I'm almost like a filter for Maria's work. And I think, you know, I would edit it more at the start, and then Maria, like, learns how I'm going to edit it. And then I think over time, she gets closer and closer and closer. And eventually, it's like, hey, you can do it on your own. I don't need to edit so much. and I think that's a great way to, like, implement writers into your team.
That makes sense. Can you tell me, like, today, for a typical issue, how does it come together? I know that, you know, there is some of the news-based stuff in the weekdays, but I'm sure you're bringing together some of these stories and bits days before a given issue. Walk me through, like, soup to nuts, how a given issue comes together today.
I'm chronically online. I'm, you know, looking at everything everywhere. I may not be a TikTok user, but I am a TikTok scroller, and I get through doom scrolling. Doom scrolling gets me a lot of information. Like people think that fries your brain. Sometimes, yes, but it gives me a lot of information, and that's how sometimes I get my information. But I think traditionally, when we used to look at AI news before, it used to be some sort of like subsection and like a secondary sort of thing. Now it's everywhere. So it's not something that I struggle anymore to find. What I struggle to find is basically breaking news, because sometimes the news gets to be redundant, like update here and update there. I just want something juicy. Usually what happens is that a day before, I would send Matt what we should talk about that day, and he would approve and then write about it. When it comes to the other sections, it's usually the trivia things, which I enjoy the most, really. That's where I get creative. You know, I get, you know, mystery links here and some sort of like fact here and fact there. When I write the facts, which is the first thing that we have in the newsletter, I have so much fun with it. I think I get out all of the wit that is inside me just into that section specifically, because it makes me feel like I'm being heard. Like it makes me feel like whomever is reading this is reading my tone, because that's how I feel about everything. So
So we have an intro fact Monday through Saturday, and then Sunday I do like a little editor's note thing. But the concept for this was like, it's almost supposed to be like an appetizer. So it's like you open the newsletter, you read a few sentences that are interesting, you go, oh, and then you carry on reading. And also like almost like an addiction thing, because you want people to want to open it every day. And we've had people write in and be like, I just open it for the facts. And I'm like, the system works.
They do. It does. Really, it does.
Yeah. So on the, because you're asking about the kind of daily process. So for example, for me, I'll get up in the morning. And then I'll have what Maria's written the evening before. I'll edit it. I'll add my bits, which we have. I know Maria said trivia. We have like a rotating trivia that I generally handle. I'll do all the like subject lines and any like partnerships we have. So lead magnets, cross promotions. I'll like edit it all, set up an A/B test, which goes out at 1 p.m. So one of the decisions we made early on, we used to schedule at 11 a.m. we realized most of our audience was in America, so like 11 a.m. in the UK is like 5 a.m. on the West Coast, or even earlier. So at one point I was like, there's no need to schedule so early, let's push it back. So we started scheduling at 1
3 a.m. on the West Coast even.
Oh god, no wonder our open rate was so low. So we started scheduling at 1 p.m. but with an A/B test. So we do a 3-hour A/B test This gives us like almost like a built-in buffer. So if for whatever reason we can't get it done by one, then we can just reduce the length of that A/B test. So it gives us a hard deadline, but then also a hard deadline that worst case scenario we can miss.
I do that with Creator Spotlight as well, but yeah. Maybe I should do it longer. We do about a 1 hour A/B test, and then if we miss that deadline, then we have 1 hour left. But I should get it done earlier. That's what I'm learning.
Pro tip.
Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
Yes. So we made that decision to move it to 1 PM, which gives us more time, and then afternoon is kind of like more like strategy stuff. I'll work on the weekend stuff. So I generally handle the weekends. So we're kind of I'll get those kind of going throughout the week, and then Friday afternoon I'll schedule the Saturday and the Sunday, which gives us the whole weekend off, which for a long time we didn't have. I used to write the weekend ones in just like on the Saturday and Sunday mornings, which is crazy to think about. I don't know how I did that. Including sometimes where I would like, you know, have gone out the night before and I'm pretty hungover, yeah. But then, you know, the newsletter has to go out, so it goes out. And then even long after Maria joined, I used to like edit Maria's work on the Saturday and Sunday mornings, because again, I think we were still doing news at this point. So giving that kind of weekend separation where the content changes up and it's longer form stuff and we've got a bit of support from freelancers, you know, gives us time to unwind over the weekend, which I think is, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so you guys are both doing some writing and some editing, and there's some freelancers as well involved here.
Yes. So we have generally our longer form content is freelancers. So we have a kind of bank of that, and then I'll go through and kind of edit it. So you'll see on our Saturdays, we have Hannah, and she, so it's kind of her work I'm editing. And then we've just hired like last week, another freelancer to kind of build the team out a bit more, give us a bit more respite. And, we've got big plans this year, right? So Maria's like moving into video a bit more. So we need to take some stuff off of her plate and let her shine on YouTube.
Yeah. Matt, I want to go back to the beginning a little bit. So in your 100th issue, you wrote that you were stumbling around in the dark at the start, and then again, that you were trying to make the newsletter 1% better every day. Can you give me one or two concrete examples of these 1% improvements that stumbled you out of the dark?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, we're always focusing on like improvement. So if you look at our very first edition, which by the way is on our website, if anyone wants to see it, it's there and it's ugly. Like you can see like where we, you know, we started as the caveman and now we're like the businessman in the suit.
You come out of the gate hot, by the way. One of the first lines I was reading earlier, I'm paraphrasing, but something like, welcome to the hottest AI newsletter on the internet. So you said that to like five people.
Yeah, one of which was my dad.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just continuous like feedback, you know, our own thoughts. We would rigidly analyze like how many people are clicking on things. So at one point we did a whole process where we reviewed all of our features, and we used to be 7 days a week, seven features, and like the two that got the least clicks, we just like killed them off and came up with new features. We're just very, and the reader feedback plays a role as well. So I built like an automation now where anytime anyone leaves us feedback, it like pings to us in Slack. And you know, a lot of it you can just ignore because it's just people saying, oh, great. Or like, you know, nothing constructive, but sometimes someone says, I want to see more of this, or like, thank you so much for this. And then we're like, oh, we need to do more of that. And sometimes people will be like, oh, the answer in today's trivia was wrong, but I'm like, it wasn't wrong. And they leave their email. So like I had one where some guy like wrote this in, and then within like 1 minute of his feedback submission, I replied to him and was like, no, it wasn't wrong. Here's why. He replied like facing his leg, like, oh, thank you. I wasn't expecting that. So yes, we keep an eye on the feedback always.
Sometimes we get these feedbacks, and I screenshot them and send them to Matt. It's like, I don't like when someone tells me what to do. Usually it's like I'm not going to say a man. I'm just going to say something like, don't talk about this or don't talk about that. And it feels like an attack to me as a writer. And like, I send it to Matt, and Matt's like, just ignore them. Like, they don't even know what they're talking about. They're just miserable and stuff like that. So it's really, yeah. It's really good to have Matt, you know, like, kind of balance
stabilizing influence.
Yeah, because I'm always on, you know, fire and just chaos, and there's always my like calming me down, you know, like, don't take this personal, it just happens.
Wait, tell me more about the relationship with the audience, though, because you have run these feedback polls pretty much since the beginning. I used to run these in Creator Spotlight. Also, I stopped doing it because there was some attrition. I think that people vote on them enough times and then they don't need to keep voting on them. Or any feedback I got was basically zilch at a certain point. But you still run these. But beyond just the polls, tell me about the relationship with the audience. Is there like some extended correspondence with people? Anything else about the relationship with the audience?
Yeah, we take it pretty seriously. We think it's like a crucial part of like a successful media company, if you will, where we want our audience to root for us. We want a connection with them. So like we run the feedback polls, but every article we have a poll as well. So we're getting people writing in their opinions every day, and they do. We get like hundreds of people writing in every day, which is awesome. We have people submitting artwork. Obviously, there's the feedback. We have a welcome sequence, right? So when you join Mindstream, you enter this automation where you're slowly told the story of Mindstream from mine, Maria's, and Adam's perspectives. The purpose of that is to get the audience to know us and like us, so they're less likely to leave. And you know, we put our pictures in every email because we want people to know it's us there writing it. You know, it's not being written by, like, it's not outsourced to anybody. It's us writing it. We want that personal connection. And we think that builds like a greater connection, but just you want the readers to root for you. And they're more likely to engage. You're building like a community, and not, you know, it's not just a list. It's a community. That's how we see it.
Mm-hmm. On the topic of AI tools, briefly on how you guys use AI, are there specific tools that have become indispensable to your process? How do you actually use AI tools in your own work?
I mean, in my case, obviously, I'm not a native English speaker, by the way. English is my third language because I know French and Arabic are my two, you know, main ones because I had to learn them in school. Sometimes I would make mistakes, and AI has come to my aid on several occasions. You know, I make a lot of grammatical errors sometimes, and I would just like write them because I'm human at the end of the day. And Claude usually is the one to hold my hand and tell me that it's not, you know, it's not you, it's not your brain. It's just, you know, it is what it is. You can do mistakes. And whatever I sort of coach Claude to find out where I make these mistakes, I sort of copy whatever it gave me and write it down again just to make sure that I retain it in my brain so that I can, like, you know, not make these again. That's how I get to learn with Claude, honestly. That Claude is my savior in everything.
I use Claude in writing as well, yeah.
I love them.
In terms of our day to day, Midjourney is like indispensable. So all of our images in the newsletter are Midjourney. So that's two a day. That, like, if there was no AI tool for that, we would need like a graphic designer that was like pumping out these images. But it gives us the freedom to basically have like an infinite variety of stock imagery that, like, you know, we can tailor it to what's in the article, which is awesome. So Midjourney is like we use that every single day, and that's awesome. And then, yeah, Claude is amazing. I've recently like switched from ChatGPT to Claude, like in most of what I do. And yeah, it's just fantastic for just turning ideas into drafts. Even like any kind of code that's on our website. So recently it's a Beehive website, on our subscribe page, I've added a little like testimonial banner. That's all coded by Claude. And it's like, it gives me the power to, in our little team of two, to like make improvements to the Mindstream experience without having to engage a web developer or anything like that. It's like, it gives us more power and productivity. We like to describe ourselves as the like per capita kings in the HubSpot media world, because it's like me and Maria, we pump out 7 newsletters a week, which is more than anyone else. And they've all got bigger writing teams than us. And I think that's AI supporting us. That's Beehive being amazing. And it's these like rock solid processes that allow us to do that. But it's like the return they get from us too is pretty substantial. So we are the kings and queens.
So on the topic of, you know, being the per capita rulers of the HubSpot media network, I believe you signed the HubSpot deal, the acquisition, on October 16th, 2024, which would have been day 503. Sending Mindstream, or maybe give or take. Tell me how that felt.
Great mass.
What that represented.
it was pretty crazy. Obviously, it had been a very long time in the kind of fire. So I think it was about a 6-month process. Maria, from when they first expressed interest to actually getting over the line. Maria, we didn't tell you till very, very late on as well. So like me and Adam were like going into these meetings. Okay, well, you still have a while then. But, you know, we would go into these meetings that would be like, you know, would feel make or break. And sometimes we'd come out and be like fist pumping and I'd go on and call Maria and be like, so how was your day? Like completely zen. you'd have to like completely hide it. And it's the same like our families. Like we didn't tell our families. I told just my dad. But until it was done, I told, you know, put a big message in my family group chat and everyone was like, whoa.
Maria, how did you feel?
Honestly, I told Matt the minute that he told me it felt like a lifeline. Cause I don't know if you know, but around that time, all hell broke loose. We didn't know who was with who and like how everything, I'm not going to go into the politics of this.
Yeah.
Because people
but
know.
In Lebanon, yeah.
But everything was so bad that I was just, you know, not feeling the best. And these guys were going on a call with me every single day of every hour just to make sure that I'm all good, my brain is good, that I can actually pump out these newsletters, but also my mental health is fine.
Yeah.
I looked at them, when I saw, the first thing that Matt told me, he's like, so do you have any relatives in the United States? I was like, I do have an uncle in Long Island. Why are you asking me this? He's like, well, just because you mentioned it once and whatever. So they went on a call with me and his smile was like up here and he's like, we want to tell you something, but we don't know how you're going to take it. We got acquired by HubSpot and part of the acquisition is that we need to relocate or like kind of get the team together and they need to relocate you to where the HubSpot have like HQs and stuff. I was like, I just stared at them for like 50 minutes because I didn't know what to do and like how it felt like a lifeline.
Yeah.
But I decided to move to the UK, obviously, to get closer to them. I feel like getting closer to them is, you know, the goal for it all because the team needs to be together to get on meetings and like go mm-hmm. to these events and stuff like that. But yeah, that's how I think I didn't sleep that day. I think I just stared at nothing because I was like uprooting my whole existence to the UK.
Amazing.
So like, yeah.
Life changing.
Yeah, Maria kind of had the option of moving pretty much anywhere. So we didn't want to like load the question and be like, move to the UK. We kind of wanted it to be open. And you'd mentioned you had a relative in America and they said they would put you there if you wanted to. So but you chose to come and be with us, which is nice.
Yeah. Matt assumed that I would move to Dubai because Dubai is closer technically to Lebanon. But I was like, no, I really want to move somewhere where it's like cold as shit. And like I moved here.
Bit of a change. Yeah.
Oh man, on the working side, what changed day to day in how you guys work on the newsletter, or what didn't change? Right, maybe nothing changed. What changed? What didn't change once you got acquired?
After the acquisition, you mean?
Yeah,
nothing. Nothing really changed. For me, nothing's changed really. Just we go on more meetings than the usual because this is a huge corporation. We probably have the best management in. Honestly, for me and for Matt, we have the best management in history. Ben Berkeley is one of the best men I've ever had to work with. And this is a shout out to him. This man is basically, you know, everything I've ever wanted to in my career and in my social network. So, yeah, I think that's the only thing that changed. Just like went from meh to really up here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think going in, that was one of the things we were like anxious about. Like, we kind of assumed there would be like a curtailing of freedoms and maybe like a bit more, you know, things would be like dictated to us about what we needed to write. And then we got in there and it was kind of like, okay, guys, carry on doing your thing, which is pretty great. Like we really didn't know what to expect. And yeah, the kind of balance is amazing. Like, you know, it's still very much our product. You know, it's me deciding what goes in it. It's me like fiddling with the website and trying out new things. Which is great because you know it still feels like that project that it always felt like, but now we have like the backing of experts. Mm. So rather than like me trawling through data and deciding about ads, it's like the team gives it to me. You know, I just have to focus on the editorial. It's like all of the sticky stuff has been taken away, and now we can focus on like what we're good at.
So functionally, it's like the only real change was ads instead of like Adam going out and selling ads to various people, and then you having to work on the copy. There's just HubSpot ads and you don't have to write them.
Yeah. So we use like a lead magnet system. So it's kind of like we give away resources that are AI relevant to our audience. And then to get those resources, you have to sign up and then HubSpot can send you marketing emails basically. So it's like a long funnel. Mm-hmm. We're near the top of it. But it's a great system because we're giving resources that our readers want, right? So it's like 50 ChatGPT prompts. So people are, oh, I want that. And then that gets them in the funnel. And we're always updating and changing these offers. So it doesn't feel like an ad because it's relevant. It's like, here's some AI resources, rather than before it was like, you can try this AI tool for just for 50% off in 3 months. It's like, you know, it's a lot dirtier than a free resource, isn't it?
I think shortly after you quit your job to do this full time, you and Adam acquired another newsletter called AutoGPT. And the big interesting difference here is they had over 100,000 subscribers, where you guys were just over 5,000, but they weren't really able to crack the editorial side on quality and consistency, right? And so the much smaller newsletter acquired the much bigger newsletter. Obviously, editorial quality and consistency is a moat here. Tell me a bit about that and like the differences between the newsletters and how that acquisition went.
Yeah, so AutoGPT was run by a kind of friend in the space called Matic. He was running our newsletter. We were sort of friends of him through LinkedIn. He was, you know, we would go on kind of strategy calls because we were doing similar things. Whereas his newsletter was run by a freelancer and it was going out 3 or 4 times a week. And he had built up an incredible audience because his website had like gone viral. So at one point he was getting like 10,000 a day or whatever. Like it was just insane numbers. But he wasn't able to deliver that product to them, like editorial product, I mean. So, you know, he had the newsletter going out and it was like, you know, okay. It was like half the length of Mindstream. There wasn't a lot to it. It was filled with kind of ads for, he sold courses. So it was kind of like upselling as well. Whereas we were very much like, the newsletter is the product. So we had that, this kind of like this engine, this like publishing engine where, you know, every single day me and Maria are like pumping out this newsletter. This was before Maria joined. Every single day I was pumping out a newsletter. And we knew that like that was what we could win on, right? So we added all these subscribers. The newsletter got way better. So the ones that were reading it for that were like very happy. But we also learned pretty fast that like you can't just really buy a big list because, you know, a lot of them churned out within 6 or 12 months. But that taught us a valuable lesson about kind of list quality as well over quantity. We learned it's like your list is like a garden, and it's not about growing. This is a weird analogy. It's not about growing the tallest grass, right? You have to like mow it and prune it. So like we started building automations that like, we still have these, if you don't engage, you get kicked off the list because you need a healthy list.
What kind of gate is that? Like how many hasn't opened a newsletter in 31 days? Like what is it?
Very similar to that. I think it's 55 days. Mm. And then, so they don't just get kicked out. They enter an automation where we send them a few emails to try and grab their attention. So we're like, hey, you haven't opened us, or like, can you see this kind of thing? And then anyone who engages back in the list, anyone who reaches the end of that gets removed. And I think we find through that, we managed to salvage like 10, 15%. So it's a very valuable thing to have one of these like exit sequences. Yeah.
Yes. Okay, Maria, I want to start with you on this one. What have you learned about newsletter writing specifically writing for this format that you did not know that you had to learn, that you did not know when you started?
When I used to write newsletters before for marketing companies, like marketing agencies, it used to be some sort of like salesy, product, you know, it was like promotions and stuff like that. And then I shifted into, before I shifted into that, I was also sending out some sort of digest for people that, you know, missed out on this journalistic webinar, et cetera. So moving into AI, first of all, it was so refreshing, you know, to move from something that I used to do to something I didn't even know about, like researching this from scratch and trying to see how people talk about it. It felt the pressure was less, by the way. I don't know if people agree with me, but the pressure of sending something that people have to click on rather than something kind of people can skim through is way less than, it's just, it feels better. It feels refreshing. I get to be as creative as I can be, and there's someone behind me, you know, editing through it if I misspell something. But yeah, honestly, this is the highlight of my career. I've said this once, and I said this again. This is the highlight of my entire career. I don't think I can leave this. The more that I discover myself in newsletter writing, the more that I really want to stay. I can't find myself anywhere else writing something else.
Amazing. Matt, to you, anything you've learned about writing the newsletter format that you didn't know when you started out?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So in my last job, I worked in a marketing agency. So we would run newsletters for other people, but that was like a very small part of it. So these were like once a month newsletters, and it tended to be like announcing products and stuff like that. So it was very, very dry, like the tone and like the format. So kind of going into this was kind of like me freeing myself from that and like having fun with it. And then another thing about newsletter writing is I find this when I hire freelancers. So a lot of like writers that say, oh yeah, I can write newsletters. Their main experience is like blog writing, which is great, but it's like SEO blogs. So it's like they say, look at my portfolio, and then you open your portfolio and then it's like the best AI tools in 2026. And it's like, are you looking for the best AI tools in 2026? And you know, they're ticking all these SEO boxes. And I'm like, we can take those shackles off you now. you can just write and have fun with it. Like the audience is already through the door, which is what's great about a newsletter. Like they're already reading. Whereas when you write a blog, you're trying to draw them in. So I think that's amazing because it allows you to be more concise as well. Like, you know, these 2000 word SEO blogs. You can be concise, you can be fun. The audience is there. You're not begging for attention. You're just having fun being yourself. So I think that's
what are you optimizing for? That if you're not optimizing for, obviously it is not search engine optimization to write a newsletter. What do you think of yourself as optimizing for whenever you're writing a newsletter?
Basically opens. You want people to open it. And there's like a, you know, gamification aspect. You know, we have the number at the bottom that hasn't always been there. We had this idea really early on, which I still would love to implement. I don't know if it's possible, but like the idea of like a Duolingo style streak where it's like you open it and it goes, you've opened it for 10 days in a row. And then the idea would be that if you got to like 500, you would get like gift cards and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we think just getting people to open it is such a big deal. Most of that's subject lines. But I always think when we're writing a newsletter, you're not competing with like BBC News. You're competing with TikTok, Instagram, because people are reading these on their phone, right?
Yeah.
So it's like you need to be good enough that people will turn their attention away from these like addictive like scroll mechanisms. So we always said it needs to be kind of in your face a bit. We need to make it addicting, but you know, in a nice way. Like we want people to come and do the trivia every day, not you know, not get super addicted to socials or whatever. Yeah. But it's like that's what you're competing with. So
well, it's really quick too. Like, I mean, I've been taught at a previous job, a manager told me, like, you know, we're not competing with other companies in our space. We're competing with anything you can look at on your phone, right? So I definitely agree with that. But on the optimization tip, you are referencing this number. So I think this is the trivia. You open the newsletter and there's a question near the top. And then the answer, the number, is way down at the bottom, which this is a classic trick. I am not a Morning Brew reader anymore, but I used to be back in the day. And I, at a certain point, I didn't really read it anymore. I would just open it for like, here's the trivia question, and then scroll down at the bottom. And another newsletter I've interviewed, Garbage Day, they do a thing like this where it's like in the preview line is like, scroll to the bottom for XYZ, like funny thing. It's like a funny link. And then at the bottom, there's this link. And he told me, Ryan Broderick, who runs Garbage Day, he uses that as a measure of like, it's like a deeper measure of engagement, like that you can optimize for not just opens, but this person clicked the thing at the bottom. And that's like telling him like that allows him to optimize for like a particular type of reader who's coming back.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. And you know, Beehive has like a trivia feature built in, and we used to use that, but we realized it's more powerful to just get people to scroll to the bottom than to get the answer straight away. So we started putting it at the bottom. I think a lot of people read it for that, which is fine. Like read it for whatever you like. We just want people to read it.
Mm-hmm. One thing obviously with writing a newsletter that is every day, even though you don't literally write it every day anymore, it can get exhausting. I'm sure you can get a little burnt out. What's the hardest part of that consistency? What's the thing that, you know, makes you pull out your hair most often?
Even though I've told these guys because Matt and Adam used to say, like, are you sure you're okay? Like, you can take the day off, or like, you can just, because you've been writing this for like quite some time every single day. And it never really felt like a job, but sometimes I would just reach, you know, the peak of it all. I just want to sleep, and I just don't want to talk about AI. I don't want to see anything about Sam Altman. I don't want to see anything about anybody in the AI space. Like, I don't, you know, if I've had enough. But then, I kind of like go out on a walk. I feel like when I go out on a walk and like buy a book that I'm not going to read until the, you know, the next month, because I have so many books on my TBR. So it's huge. And then I come back and I see these feedbacks of these people that actually really want to read it. And it makes me feel like I need that kind of like, you know, like acceptance from them, and then this kind of feedback, and this sort of, I don't know how to explain this, but the more that I see their feedback, the more I really want to write it. They're boosting my ego so much that I just really, I'm craving for it. So I feel like that's what makes me keep on going without having to lose my shit. Yeah.
I love it. Matt?
Yeah, I think when you've done it like 1,000 days in a row, like the main, it's almost like brushing your teeth. Like it just becomes such second nature that it's so embedded. And, you know, there's little frustrations every day where I'm like, I have to do this same thing every single day in Beehive. Can't they just automate this or whatever? Like there's lots of stuff like that. But again, it's like with Maria, we get nice reader feedback, and it's like, you know, I really like my job. It's really nice to have people say, oh, this was brilliant today. Like, thank you so much for writing that. You know, it's like we make people's days better, and it's, you know, it's like it's a nice thing to do. And it makes it easier to do, I think.
Do you have specific goals for, let's say, I mean, maybe I'm making an assumption to say that you make it to 2,000 issues. I'm sure that's the idea here, but 2,000 is quite a ways away. It's about, you know, 3 years away. Do you have any specific goals you're setting for that next long span?
I personally, as a person that writes it, I really want some kind of insider sources where we can get like breaking news without having to wait for like other news outlets to come out so that I can read it and then come out. I would love for me just to get these sort of like insider, you know, news. That's my goal. That's me.
You want to develop more into a journalist properly.
Well, yeah. I mean, we do write about this because someone else wrote about it, but I kind of really want to be able to kind of reach out to these journalists or like reach out to these, you know, like big conglomerates and like ask them if they can give me some sort of, you know, the news before someone else so that we get to cover it. Yeah. That would be an awesome goal.
We've had, you know, a few times where this kind of has worked. Like we got invited to Google. So like me and Maria went to like Google HQ and we got to like ask questions to their head of search, which was like pretty surreal. But it's, I think we want like more consistency of that. Like, you know, we want like better relationships with like big companies, and stuff like that. I'd love to do more interviews. So we've just launched a kind of limited interview series, which is like, a kind of text-based interview that's going out kind of every other Sundays. And we have a few of those lined up, which is awesome. But, you know, I'd love that to be like Zuck, you know, I want Mindstream to be like a bigger name. I want people to want to come to Mindstream and speak to Mindstream. And I think, you know, as we expand into other formats, like, you know, we've got some YouTube stuff cooking that we've spoken about, that's going to feed more into the newsletter. And we're going to kind of build this kind of content sphere that can like feed into each other. So, you know, some of the newsletter stuff can go into the YouTube, some of the YouTube can go into the newsletter. And I think that's a smart way of doing it as well, because then you're getting more value out of all the content you create.
I don't have any more questions. Is there anything else you all would like to leave the audience with before we leave off?
I mean, keep reading Mindstream, I guess. Give us nice feedbacks. I read the feedbacks, guys. So like, please be kind, because it hurts my feelings sometimes. But we're so happy that you're reading it. Please keep on reading it. And what else, Matt? What do we
say? I just want to emphasize like the power of consistency and discipline. Like anyone can like get on Beehive and start a newsletter, but like how many can send it 1,000 days in a row? Us. And you know, you can do it as well. Maybe you can have this amazing experience too and build a big business. So
perfect.
Start it and stick it up.
That's the best piece of advice. Thank you both for coming on. This was fun.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Perfect. And listener, I will see you next week.
Hi there. My name's Tom. I'm the producer of the Creator Spotlight podcast. If you liked that episode, I'd recommend this episode with Adam Biddlecombe. He's Matt's co-founder in Mindstream, and he talks a lot more about the business side of things, how they went from nothing to being acquired by HubSpot in less than 2 years. Give that one a listen, because that's a great episode too.